So you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
When a competent observer looks for signs of despotism in a community, he looks beyond fine words and noble phrases.
It's society. They work for each other. They pay each other. They buy houses. They get married and make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
Go into the automobile business and compete with the auto trust? Can I go into the grocery business and compete with the chain stores? Not a chance. Monopoly is the menace of free enterprise.
Because it's just a big money-making machine. They're wandering through a maze of inauthentic, fake landscapes, and they can't escape.
The message in all this is that the capitalist system in America is unfair and is, in fact, a failure at providing for basic human needs or maintaining continued national growth.
I can't wait for, like, the episode of, like, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where all the contestants, like, team up and they overpower the host and they share the money.
Bottom-up horizontal connection is sharing at all levels, not top-down control.
We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Because as communities go, so goes the nation.
Welcome, welcome. This is a live edition of Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, your Limbaugh of the Left. This program covers news, issues, thoughts, and activism, and anything of interest from a radical left perspective for the curious or the committed, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy. Three Left Show is for going in a different direction. I'm going to open the show with a vamp about local news, which I predict, will be national news soon, maybe in another week. So about a year or so ago, you know, to fix the issue of police brutality in our cities and the disproportionate use of force against black people, people of color, body cameras was the fix. Spend money, a lot of good welfare for the companies that make the body cameras. To me, it was more of a kind of, like I said, a corporate welfare program to distribute and pay. We won't pay to, you know, invest in our communities. The Fed won't pay for restorative justice or other type of peace-promoting programs. We'll just spend money to make the police a bit more accountable. And yes, it was just demonstrable that body cameras had some positive effects. And at the moment, we're kind of seeing that in that the police do very bad things all the time, but it's not caught on camera, or when a civilian catches it on camera, it doesn't count, it's thrown away, or the police intimidate them into deleting it, or will actually just take their phone. Here in Albany, we have a case where basically it was a group of police, you know, they have backup and everything, and they were going up to a problem house, lots of noise complaints over probably a good amount of time. I think every neighborhood has one of these in Albany, or at least every few blocks has, you know, where a lot of guys live or there's big parties. And when they get there, they turn the music off and they're chilling. And basically what happens is the owner of the house doesn't open the door for the cops. And the cops basically kind of nod at each other and when they say, like, okay, kick in the door, you know. And they were going up to this house we have all the body cam footage from multiple angles. And basically one of the cops in particular beat the crap out of one of these guys, and they all had their hands up the whole time. They weren't reaching or whatever, you know. They were swearing at the cops and they were being rude or whatever, not complying, whatever. But hey, what were the charges? You know, he was basically explaining, okay, I'll have the guys leave, party's over, gotcha. And it's like, no, we're going to take you in. We're going to, like, we want you to leave the house. We want you to open the door. And basically kicks in the door, no warrant. He's asking for one. It's interesting, you know, it's funny, you know, there's some of the activists have Know Your Rights workshops, and they're kind of, they lament how people don't come, or maybe they distribute flyers to door to door. I think that's what they need to do more of. Maybe they do. And lament that not enough people know their rights, because if they did, the police would have a much harder time. They would need to change their approach, and they wouldn't be able to intimidate and bully people, which is what they do. Even the community police in Albany, and I've heard it from their own mouth, that they complain that the parents around here aren't beating their kids enough. They're not beating their kids enough. And it's interesting because whenever a parent does beat their kids, even if it's slapping on the wrists, and I did see this on the bus just recently, you have two parents and a toddler, And the toddler's just being a toddler. You know, it's can't really communicate what they want. They just want to hold things, or they just want to mess with things. And it's interesting, my sister-in-law and brother kind of use a little bit of sign language so that when the baby or toddler is hungry, they'll use like the, you know, mouth or eating sign. Just the simple signs to communicate that they want food or water. And I kind of suggest that jokingly, and they just kind of like don't know what the hell I'm talking about. Because they're getting upset and annoyed at their toddler. And eventually, like, hit him on the wrist, and of course crying, not too long, but still, like, crying toddler, wonderful. And it's, I know the mindset's like, well, we gotta beat them now, or else the cops will beat them later. And it'll be worse if it's the cops. But of course, it's never, like, why don't we just get the cops to stop beating it? And of course, there's a hopelessness about that. That we just need to suck up to the oppressors, suck up to people in charge. But if you know your rights, you can actually block them quite a lot. And if you block them enough, yeah, they'll get riled up, mad, and beat the crap out of you. But there'll be witnesses, or you make sure there are witnesses. And now there are body cameras. Now there's a technological official capacity witness. Okay, not a random passerby with a phone. That has a different process involved. But now this is the official recording. Can't tamper with this. This is in City Hall now. And it's all caught on camera, not only like on around the house, but then in the street, you know, the guy wields a baton, and they're using like riot-sized mace. Okay, not the small, like, defense, like, personal defense, but like the kind that you use to spray a crowd. And they're coming into like a regular-sized house with it. And they're spraying it, and the guy's on the outside, and basically, and everyone who is coming outside for the house are basically choking on the fumes. And then, like, some of the other officers are like telling the guy to chill, trying to rein him in, but not really. And they're doing it as a team. You know, like, when they come up, like, the guy's literally, like, spitting on the sidewalk, like, it's captured on camera. It's like, that will always be very stuck in my mind. Okay, so I'm going through most of my intro time here. This is, I'm going to talk about electoral politics this episode. I haven't done so in a while, but I'm definitely going to come out in a way that you probably have not heard. First, this half of the show, first hour, I'm going to be talking about elections from an anarchist and then from a socialist site about referendum processes and how to get money out of politics or how to do electoral reform because it's so desperately needed. But there really aren't a lot of good strategies out there for how it all seems to be flopping around, so to speak. And I'll give some examples of that. But first, the anarchist case against elections, against participating in elections, and sort of against voting. But I think the case against voting as a personal action is, of course, very superficial to me, and that's why I will also cover an anarchist case for voting, just for voting. And I'll add in my case for actually participating in elections, as some have. And there's always kind of like this critique layered on it that's like, so let's go through that. Now, I don't have an article up in front of me because it's basically there's a series of essays. I'm calling it the rundown of anarchist rundown of against electoralism. This is from the Black Rose Federation. They basically compiled a series of 15 essays. I'm not going to read all of them. Okay, I'm just summarizing them via some notes I took, so I may be a little random. I'm just going to go to. So the major theme is that struggles need to stay our struggles. Political struggles, economic struggles, any kind of struggle. Struggle of love. Need to stay where we live, where we study, where we work. And that is not in the house power. Social movements are stronger than electoral movements or winning elections. And social movements usually, if not always, lose once they engage with state power, meaning elections and lobbying the state to do things. If you just have your social movement and charge for change, if you're powerful enough, eventually power will yield to you. Once you have leverage through striking, leverage through blocking highways, disrupting the natural order, the order. So part two, and these are in parts, but basically each of these parts is a different essay by a different person. One is called The Lure of Elections. Movements usually make change without office holders, without having office, like their members in office. Occupy movement that I was part of was a social movement, and it shifted many people's attitudes before the Sanders campaign. Usually this kind of new dialogue about socialism is credited to the Sanders campaign. But I can tell you, my personal journey can attest, as well as many others I know, we're all thinking about these things and changing our politics in a more radical direction because of the Occupy movement, not the Sanders campaign. The Sanders campaign is kind of like Trump, a symptom of an underlying change in attitudes. There's a contrast of the bloc left by elections. Electing people in a movement saps people's resources, and the costs outweigh the benefits. Major changes in historically have happened when social struggles were at their height, not electoral struggles. Elections are also transactional. Oh yeah, the very goal of winning an election is for the supporters to then disengage. You know, we've elected our person, they'll handle it. Elections also set dates for the struggle, you know, a date that's set by our very institutions that we're trying to change, overturn, whatever. It also personalizes the solutions with candidates. Part three, next essay, is why elections fail to bring change. So it describes that there is a system of filters put in place to contain and control, to prevent a majority from ever ruling. All of these filters are usually put in place every time the franchise is ever expanded. So in American history, the franchise was, say, expanded to non-property owning white males. Then a new filter was put in place. Then the franchise was added to black men. Then another filter is put in place. Then women are given the franchise. Another filter is put in place. And anytime there's a reform to, say, make things more democratic, again, another filter is put in place. Like after the 60s, you have the superdelegates in the Democratic Party and other type of things to make sure that grassroots movements don't take over the party. But here are some of the filters put upon, say, our everyday people when it comes to engaging in elections. There's the filter of costs. You have to have enough money or raise enough money, which means you need, at very least, middle-class supporters who have property owners and so on. They're not working. They're professionals. There's the filter of media access. There's the separation of powers. So we could take Congress, but then there's still the judicial. There's still the executive branch with all of its powers. Separation of powers is, in fact, you know, it's on purpose, and this is all written in the political science literature, so to speak, of the founding fathers, that, oh, separation of powers makes sure we don't have the anarchy of democracy. We don't actually want the common people to, you know, be in charge. They're dumb. Let's see, there's the filter of scaremongering and counter-smearing, any kind of, whenever a radical surge happens. And there's what's called house training, like a dog. But in this case, like once, say, you have an office holder from a radical place, they have to be trained and they're written down. And AOC is kind of doing a good job of fighting this, you know, when she's basically in the house training class or the seminar, she like basically tweets about it. And I think that's a difference of our communication systems now, the ability to do that. Otherwise, she would kind of be isolated in those situations. And then once you actually, there's a filter of expertise. Electors are undermined by experts and other things. And civil process. And taking power, you actually have to carry out the policy of power. So this is a bigger issue, but we can say elect these democratic socialists, but you'll notice that many of them don't have an anti-war or anti-imperialist line about them. They're not really critiquing the empire. They're not talking about cutting the military budget. Maybe privately they hold these positions, but they are not public and shouting about them. Even Tulsi Gabbard will talk about, you know, it's again that kind of like, look, I'm not anti-war. I'm just anti bad wars. I want more measured responses. You know, we need to be deliberate when we send the troops out. But that's still not an anti-war stance, saying, yeah, war is bad. We should not do war. We should be diplomatic, and we should build political coalitions and have super global organizations for that to create peace. So there's also, describes careerism. When you do get people in office, you know, they have to gain influence to make things happen. Oh, yes. Oh, sorry. And this is also the kind of avenues that capital forces, okay, the system itself, capitalism, uses to block change. So there's the careerism of absorbing people, and it's like, well, you can't get things done within capitalism if you don't play our game by our rules. And then there's market terrorism, which is the phrase that can be subscribed to, if you raise taxes, we'll leave. Or if you regulate us more, we'll shut down the factories. We'll take our money elsewhere. That is a form of terrorism because you're basically holding communities hostage. It's like, you have to follow our demands. We have the power in this relationship. If you don't acquiesce, we'll leave and leave nothing. I mean, here in Albany, our economy was gutted. Not gutted, but kneecapped. Kneecapped is the word I want. When in the 90s, we had these large insurance companies here in Albany, I guess, and when they left, a large tax base hole was created. And ever since, we've been trying to, refill the tax base. But it's been kind of touch and go because anything that has to come to Albany, or say, let's say your Rust Belt city, or even Sunbelt city now, the taxes have to be low. Which means you're not actually getting the revenues for public and social services. And this is a case, it's different up here in the north, but like say in the Sun Belt, you just have low taxes and you just keep them low to attract or retain capitalists. Up here, we have to basically kind of bribe them by saying, like, okay, you don't have to pay taxes for 20 years and then you'll pay the normal rate that we actually have. And after market terrorism, if that fails, then a coup. But that's the last resort. So part four, fourth essay here, is from a campaign consultant. So someone who's kind of an ex-campaign consultant. And he kind of adds on to, kind of repeats the parts from part one. So I didn't cover part one because this is kind of, he goes through that. So the main asset of our communities is time, also known as human capital. Local campaigns strip mine this resource. This is the way he puts it. Elections are too short-term. They are working via the state or landlords or the boss, and working via them is in itself a sign of hopelessness and giving it. So there's dimensions of power as well of working in elections. First is just voting. It's either A or B, usually a binary. Now, I'm in a third party. I'm trying to make it a third choice, a better choice. Then there's the part of the election, set the agenda. And where's the real influence here? And the third dimension here is the feelings that everyone has towards the sham that is our so-called democracy. And the apathy of that. And we're not going to overcome that by just kind of participating in elections the way we always have or have in my lifetime. Move on to part five, which is written by Boots Riley. He's the director of Sorry to Bother You, is the title, as well as some other radical movies. When he's on cable news, they kind of frame him as being a bootstrap story, like a personal success story. He didn't give up. He didn't give up on his dreams, even though he was told no, and now finally he was, by act of charity, the system has allowed him to make his movies. Well, that is not the case. And I'm wondering how he's kind of dealing with that in the moment. I haven't watched those interviews. But when he's not on cable news, he is a hardcore socialist, and he's not for electoralism. And he writes, power is not in offices. Social movements lack energy, he questions. So we need movements that help pay the bills. So if we have a social movement that helps people pay the rent or not get evicted, these are the ones that are most supported. They're the ones that have good energy, and they're the ones that you can actually build off of, and where the real community power lies. There's the activism that is done at work. He's a very big, I mean, his movie, Sorry to Bother You, ends with, it kind of almost has like the same trajectory of Fight Club, but instead of full, narcissistic, nihilistic terrorism, it ends with a union drive and unionizing his workplace. You know, it's usually not a kind of storyline you see in Hollywood a lot, where, you know, unionization is the solution and the goal and the, you know, the happy ending. It's usually some individual power kind of fantasy. Power is held by capitalists, always. And liberal reforms are always responses to mass action. Whenever reforms have happened, usually in textbooks, it's framed as being just something that kind of occurred. But always behind any kind of reform, there was a mass action first. That was the impetus for the reform. And the reform is usually just a response, just to placate or to make it go away, but not really solve the problem, because if you did, then, the rich will raise the fuss. And basically, yes, market terrorism or coup. Trump has already gotten Dems to move to the right, so that was the point, that was the last point I wrote down. Let's see. Part 6, a look at Kavshara Sawant. So she's the socialist alternative candidate, office holder in Seattle. She has won re-election. So she's still on the city council, but as I covered in a previous episode, the city council can pass all kinds of progressive legislation, you know, higher minimum wage, and even they wanted to raise taxes on the super tech giants. But then they basically committed economic terrorism of a sort by leveraging all of their money and power to basically threaten the city council. We're going to unseat you if you don't repeal this, and they did. So, Socialist Alternative, the party, which only operates and active in a few cities, follows on a watered-down... So, what they do is they follow on a watered-down policy. They still lack independent power. So, Sawant won from the power of movements and the urban support that she had against a corporate Dem. So, in particular, just like with AOC, Ocasio-Cortez, these actual sort of pseudo radical left-wingers get in office because their opponent is such a corporate Dem, such a sleazeball, such a wreck, that even moderate and liberal people will say, okay, I'll vote for the Democratic Socialist, as opposed, they're the lesser evil this time. There's a lot of nicer liberal Democrats that aren't such sleazeballs, and they're safe. And they're hard to primary. In fact, no one actually wants to challenge them. We Greens talk about it, but then we need a candidate. We need someone to step up, and they don't. No one does. Which is strange. Others are intimidated by this. In a county over, we have pretty much a wreck of a sheriff from a progressive point of view, but no progressive wants to challenge him. I don't know why. It's a shady. Her victories were the result of large organizing campaigns, but she also depended upon your kind of standard unions, okay? Unions that aren't as radical, but certainly at least progressive enough that they didn't want this sleazeball corporate Dem anymore. Sawant's success and power were tied to unions. If they caved, she would have to cave. Now she needs non-voter support and a candidate. Oh, yeah, and it just makes a point that office and candidates and having office holders distract from building these movements. So just a case, movements first and foremost. Part 7 is another kind of look at a singular office holder slash candidate. The case of Larry Krieger. This is the Philadelphia district attorney who won a year or so ago. And is kind of heralded as this progressive champion, and he is. But it is a general question that is needing evidence. Are progressives in office key to passing reforms? Reforms like dropping cash bail have been done elsewhere without changing who the DA is, without some kind of electoral victory. Crasser was helped by Soros money as well as an activist ground game. Electeds usually come down to personal discretion, you know, the kind of reforms they pass, so which is not a very good model. Oh, yeah, and it prefers kind of pursue strategies, which is like a neoliberal market theory, all of us pursuing individual enterprise equal social change, which is bonk. Tactics aside, strategy is having discipline in want not to do. These are only issues to revolutionaries with bigger goals. Reformists overall should still be movements that are movements that say no to things and not yes. Yes, to this kind of large fundamental change. So those little sentences I just rambled off there, which I hadn't actually kind of gone over in my head beforehand, is just more like there's a difference. obviously in viewpoint, if you are just a progressive and you want just some reforms, then this is elections seem to make sense. But again, it's the movements themselves that bring the victories, regardless of whether you elect someone. I think sometimes there's a sense that, say, if you have this hardcore conservative Republican in office, they're never going to move, regardless of what kind of movement. But if you get enough of his supporters' base or whatever to be okay with something, and then you push from the other side, then they'll have to do something. Now, something may not be good, or it may not be what you want. Of course not. But it'll be something. There'll be some change of the status quo, which opens the door for other things to happen. Part 8, power to the people, not politicians. So this is a straight anarchist critique. To me, most superficial, but I'm going to go through it anyway. What are people being taught by elections? We are feeding hierarchies, the hierarchies of having your guy in charge. This writer kind of uses the straw man of like, this is, he's addressing someone who's only arguing for being in elections and not doing any other type of activism. You know, you get your guy in charge and then you don't have to do anything else. That's never what I'm arguing. Movements educate and do other kinds of functions. Paying the bills, for example, like I mentioned. Positives of winning elections outweigh the nature of the reformist project of even engaging with the state. It teaches us how to participate in statecraft and take part in that hierarchy. If we want to overturn these hierarchies, overturn oppression, and fight for justice, real justice, economic or otherwise, social, then we shouldn't be engaging with the things that are creating the injustice. That's what that comes down to. Part 9 is a post hoc from Jackson. So in Jackson, there's this thing called the Cooperative Jackson. That's what it's called. And it's a major kind of grassroots neighborhood movement where they go kind of block to block with these community projects. It's great. But they have a three-part plan, Cooperative Jackson. You hold people's assemblies. So you have direct democracy in the hood, people who assemble to decide what to do and get some money together, even a few thousand dollars, to fix up lots and do community farms and build their own economy. To have an independent black party in Jackson, Mississippi, and then to build a solidarity economy. So the three-part plan is, you know, the local politics, the top-down politics, and the economic side of it. Now, when they started, elections were meant to be a minor part of their plan, or at the very least a third of it. But now, but once they engaged in it, it became a major part. And in fact, let's see, what did I write? Mixed-up solutions of shifting away and making different relationships with other office holders. Okay, so that's what they're doing now. Instead of trying to get their people in office, it's just easier / more convenient and less energy intensive. You're not shifting all of this energy and resources towards electing people and trying to get through all those filters I mentioned, and instead just trying to build really good relationships. And I guess that's the strategy of people here in my hood in Albany. So it's like, okay, we do want to elect someone who's sympathetic, make sure that the most sympathetic Democrat, even if their politics and what their own opinions are not radical, or if they're radical enough, and then we just have to push and organize and have really good relationships so that when we do need something, we can talk to them and they can push for something. But I, here locally, I've been watching it my whole life. I think it's a terrible strategy. So there's what Cooperative Jackson is. It seems like a lose-lose. Like, they get office holders, but then they have to spend all this money and energy keeping them in office. And then, let's say they take over the government, local government in Jackson, Mississippi. Then what happened was then the state government stepped in and basically started legislating away all of their gains, their local economic gains. Like, literally creating legislation to punish them for trying to basically have an anti or a non-corporate economy, building a solidarity economy, one that is based on community economics. And it's like, no, you have to raise this kind of tax revenue, you have to have this kind of economic growth. And it was a fight that they, as just one city, even as one part of one city, couldn't win. So it seems like you gotta, seems lose-lose all the time. Let's see, moving on. Yeah, the movement, Cooperative Jackson, had to make compromises to keep their members in office, and they lost planks of their agenda along the way. So in order to gain them back, they needed to kind of take a step back from trying to elect people. Okay, the next part, Chapter 10, was about just about presidential elections and how they block movement building. So overall, my note on this is just that it's a rehash of the explanation and argument of sheepdogging for the Dems, that basically you have a candidate who kind of says is progressive, of Bernie Sanders, a Tulsi Gabbard. They pull social movements into the Democratic Party and their politics, where they are then mired, negated, and defused. And it forces activists to side with elites against the grassroots. And this is something I've seen over and over again. And I think you can see it in the national news if you pay, you know, if you're looking for it. You have activists who are brought on cable news and they have to make points about, like, look, we don't want to change the overlining order. You know, we don't really want to get rid of, it really helps that AOC says, like, yeah, I don't think there should be billionaires. And that's like, gasp. And then you'll have a whole army of activists who are progressive or maybe even radical privately. But then once they're on public stage and they're engaging with the Democratic Party overall, then they're not so radical anymore. Then it's like, okay, no, we can't like attack them personally. Like, we can't be directly confrontational. We need to be able to get that that donor money or the foundation, you know, that will be dropped. And you kind of see those reactions where there is a little bit of confrontation, just a slight bit. And then, say, the National Democratic Party is going to blacklist any group that works with left-wing candidates, basically. So, like, if you ever want to work in this town again, don't work for anyone like AOC. So that requires that any candidate who does that, you know, your Justice Democrats, they need to make sure that their funding base, their fundraising is consistent so that the people who know their stuff to win elections. But again, it's like it takes a lot of money, it takes all this expertise, all these filters. You know, it's not building a mass movement. You mobilize the masses for a day or a few days. Or you get a lot of people involved, but it's involved just to basically raise one person up the pyramid one level. And when we want to tear the pyramid down. Okay, so that's that. Part 11, which is about Syriza's fall from grace. So Syriza was a left-wing party, a real left-wing party, that took power in Greece for the most part. But they, as soon as they tried to implement their kind of social democratic agenda, or democratic socialist agenda, they were blocked completely by the EU. The bankers were actually in charge, and again, economic terrorism will cut you off, blah, 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 we've got you in debt. So you have a liberal state, any kind of liberal state, can't be the vehicle for socialism. So this is just the case that, look, if you're a socialist, a lefty like me, you can't really go for the state. Because whoever wins then becomes the general manager of capitalism. So this goes back to a wider point that capitalism requires state power, the government, you know, the Fed. Yes, there's that antagonism of regulation, but those, like, state and government regulations that, say, stymie business, growth, and profit-making are from previous mass movements. And, yeah, they didn't want them originally, and they don't need them now, and that's why they're getting rid of them. But as far as, saying, having a big security state, having an enormous military, having police and all the other apparatuses that are not being attacked by the right, they're fine with those. Capitalism needs that wing of the state. And whoever wins, no matter how liberal they are or left, then they then become the general manager. Take Obama, for example. He could say all kinds of leftist stuff on the campaign trail, but once he's in office, he has to save capitalism. He has to bail out the banks. He has to make sure that profit-making can continue unabated. If he doesn't, or if anyone who's elected doesn't, they're either removed from office the next time around, they're sabotaged, or the community they represent is then directly harmed. Economic terrorism. The state depends on a good taxable economy. On shifting the Overton window movements, which is an acceptable discussion, it's movements that do this, And they have a better track record of doing that than just having having people in office. I think this needs to be looked at very much harder. The difference between, like, okay, what is shifting? You know, and it's kind of like a causation fallacy. What is shifting public opinion? Say, like, this acceptance that we can even talk about socialism or lefty politics or whatever. Is it mass movements that are doing this, or is it the electing of people in office who then talk a certain way? Right? AOC is turning more people on to socialism because she is doing all these public events. Or is it that there are all of these public events that are now talking about it, in which she'll be invited to and be given the stage to say, yeah, I don't think there should be billionaires? Because her ability to make those comments and to put out the message she's putting out depends on the platforms existing. And those platforms exist because there is a bit of a hunger for more of this. And that hunger comes from a mass base. So I'm going to wrap up very quickly the case against being electoral. And these essays are about the actual real-life examples from a recent past, basically the last 6 years. The last one was Syriza, and the next one is about the Pink Tide, which is in South America. A decade ago, there was a wave of left-leaning governments elected, and now a lot of that has been rolled back. There's still some holdouts, so to speak, Venezuela, Bolivia, but otherwise a lot of right-wingers or neoliberals have taken back power. And there's some resistance, but it's still they're in power. So just a matter of course, there are no shortcuts to taking power, because there's a saying that the last day of oppression is the first day of the same. There have been increases in consumptive capacities from the Pink Tide, you know, social democratic policies, but they became ends, not the means, once social movements gained power. So the Pink Tide were social movements that gained power. They elected their people, or people that were sympathetic and going to follow through a policy, and a lot of them did. They followed through with social programs and public housing and subsidies for buses and so on, infrastructure. But a lot of that, say, growth in social spending was dependent on a robust capitalist economy, which included raping and pillaging of the earth. So, yes, the people, working people, were getting more, but the earth, the environment, had to be exploited more in order to do that. Someone has to be exploited. If it isn't the working class, it usually has to be the environment, or the people at the bottom of the pyramid. So then nature becomes another tier down. So let's see, if the left party did go all the way, it would be a civil war anyway. And by going all the way, meaning like starting to nationalize things. So all these left parties that kind of took power, they weren't able to nationalize and kind of take on corporate power. They just had to kind of work around the edges and create social programs that help people. But it didn't change the underlying situation, like the power dynamics, the structures of power. So, the right could just take power back and undo all of that, which is what's happened in Brazil. So it's kind of a two steps forward, one and a half steps back, or even three steps back. It's kind of a passive revolution. Many gains to be had, but those gains are tied to the overall system, and the right is part of that. Part 13 is about Corbyn. The Tories are in crisis due to the Corbyn movement success. This is in the UK. But capitalists are still in power. So basically it lists all of the impediments to, say, the full Corbyn agenda being carried out. So there's parliamentarism. A full majority is needed to pass major reforms. There are party machines still in operation. There's a general pragmatism that still exists. Then there's the pressure of being one man, Jeremy Corbyn. And then there's the Marxist view regarding a socialist state, which still kind of has a bit of imperialism about it. So you could have a socialist UK, is it still imperialist? It certainly can be. So the Soviet Union kind of was, and so is China. And the last part here is about South Africa. I kind of took the fewest notes, but it just boiled down to that the state generates its own elite from its very structure. You know, the hierarchy exists. So you have a pyramid, and if you get your people at the top of the pyramid, there's still the people at the top of the pyramid. So from an anarchist perspective, we need to flatten that pyramid. Flatten it, or smoosh it, destroy it, whatever. Make a make a long rectangle or a plate. Pick a plate is probably the analogy we want to have, with little bumps on it, you know. I mean, there are, and this is something I need to explain, and I'll do that now, because anarchism is such a new concept or an unknown to so many people, you listeners. Let me go through that. It is not against all hierarchy, all unequal power relationships. It's not like everyone has to be. It's not that absolute equality of like the Kurt Vonnegut story or whatever. It is against unjustifiable hierarchies. So there are justifiable hierarchies. Examples: a student and a teacher, a parent and a child. The very basic premise of direct democracy and any democracy, all democracy, is that you have experts who are good at analyzing the options and creating and disseminating the options. But that is their role. Then there's the masses, everyone else who is not an expert. The best people to determine what those options. So the experts creating the options, and it is the masses who are best at picking the options, what options are best for them. And this is the ideal, and I'm sure you may have a sense, that this is the ideal relationship with your doctor, with any kind of expert, that they are there to help you, not to lord over you or to make decisions for you, but to provide options so that you are empowered to make a decision. Because in the freedom itself, freedom, empowerment, happiness, is options. A pile of money grants you the ability to make many options, and an expert gives you the ability to make informed, to have options on the table in front of you to pick from. So there's a lot of anti-democracy talk going around, and of course anti-anarchism, whatever, is the ultimate smear of it, so to speak.
I don't drive a car because they run on gas, but if I did, it'd run on biomass. I ride a bike or sometimes a skateboard. So fuck off all you drivers and your yummy hordes sitting all day in the traffic queues. I'm a better anarchist than you. I don't eat meat. I just live on moldy chives or the donuts that I found in last week's dumpster dives. You people in that restaurant, I think you are so sad when you could have been eating bagels like the ones that I just had. I think it is a shame all the bourgeois think they do. I'm a better anarchist than you. I don't wear leather and I like my clothes in black, and I made a really cool hammock from a moldy coffee sack. I like to hop on freight trains. I think that is so cool. It's so much funner doing this than being stuck in school. I can't believe you're wearing those brand new shiny shoes. I'm a better anarchist than you. I don't have sex and there will be no sequel, because heterosexual relationships are inherently unequal. I'll just keep on moshing to Andy Flag and Crass until there are no differences in gender, race, or class. All you brainwashed readers, you just haven't got a clue. I'm a better anarchist than you. I don't believe in voting. I think consensus is the key. I don't believe in stupid notions like representative democracy.
So let's round out the hour with a very quick overview, if I can do it, manage it. But an anarchist case for voting in elections. And this is what I usually go with. So this is written by a Patty Vidpom. I'm actually reading an article now from Films for Action. And it has at the top the kind of meme slash image of whoever they vote for, we are ungovernable. I very much like that. As another election season approaches, which is always the case, we are faced with the age-old anarchist dilemma, to vote or not to vote. I do not expect this article to answer this question once for all, but I do expect it to change a few people's perceptions. As anarchists, it is our duty to question everything, even our own decisions, and as with any set of political beliefs, if they remain unchallenged, they become dogma. As I grew up and discovered the principles and the key thinkers of anarchism, I slowly began to turn my back on mainstream politics and their parties. Once I had read what I had, the seed had been planted, and it was a seed that did not need chemical fertilizer in the form of propaganda in order to develop. It grew naturally, because what I had read and discovered made sense. I did not need to be coerced and persuaded, attacked, or threatened. It was simply logical. Anarchy is the way. But within this logic, time and again, I encountered one moot point. It was a point that every anarchist had written about, and it was a point that was at odds with the logic inherent to it. What frustrated me about it was, rather than question it, we were told to do with every other belief and system, we must instead accept it. An anarchist has no place in voting in an election. That is what he's referring to. Great writers and thinkers of the past have argued it. Posters plastered on walls and buildings around Brighton. So he's writing from the UK as well. But it doesn't matter. A few anarchists online are writing about it. Anarchists should not vote, and they should be proud of not voting. As you may have guessed by the title of the article, I disagree. It has taken me a few years to reach this decision. So first, let me just go through these four main topics. One's legitimacy, fairness, cost, and effectiveness. So first, legitimacy. You know, if you vote for the bastards, you're just giving them power and excuse. Whereas P.J. O'Rourke, bladderhead he is, it's like he wrote a book called, like, Don't Vote for the Bastards, It Only Encourages Them. And he's a conservative. Anarchists that oppose voting on the issue of legitimacy argue that by participating in the election process, the government has legitimized in their role, making them the valid and rightful rulers of the country. The fact that it is possible to vote against a winning party or candidate in an election seems to be ignored here, and more importantly, so too is the fact that governments take their legitimacy regardless of voter turnout. I cannot recall a single case in history whereby a government has refused to rule a country because the number of people voting was not high enough. In the UK, 1950, 84% of the population voted. Government was elected, and the country was ruled. Despite a significant drop in voter turnout in 2001, when it was around 60%, the government was still elected, and the country was then still ruled. It matters not how many people vote in an election. A government will be legitimate regardless. Voting's only impact is on deciding which government this will be. To take the legitimacy of the voting argument to its logical conclusion, let's imagine a scenario where nobody voted. If 0% of the population cast a vote in an election, the ruling government will remain in power. And the scenario has been a reality for many people across the world. The system would be a dictatorship. And if anything, would make the rulers even more legitimate because they would argue nobody opposed their rule. As with many of the arguments given for why anarchists should not vote, the legitimacy argument seems to be no more than a selfish badge of honor. For the non-voter, it seemingly offers a get-out clause, allowing them to state, well, I didn't vote for them, to which the only response could be, yes, but you did not oppose them either. You are simply being neutral. And it allows for a warm feeling inside for the non-voter, but little else outside of it. So I'm in the middle of an article, case for anarchists voting in elections, just for voting. There's also the case for even participating in elections, meaning running for office and things. There is someone who, in Florida, a town with a very sizable anarchist population, whatever that would mean, let's say it's, you know, a few blocks. And she was an anarchist, got elected to the city council. It was just for one term. She didn't really enjoy it. and she had her own kind of critique because, I mean, basically, her critique and her response to, like, her experience was in line with a lot of those arguments I was putting forward from that cavalcade of essays that I was summarizing in the first half of the show. But it's going to work no matter what. So it's not really an argument against it. It's just kind of a disengagement from that process when really we should be opposing. We should be fighting on every battlefield possible when struggling for justice. And elections are one of those battlefields. And that, to me, is the be-all, end-all argument that it's just one of the other fields of struggle. The workplace is one. The streets are one. The courtrooms are one, you know, everything. It's everything. Everything's political. And everything is a place to fight back or to carve out your place or to build community. So next, kind of part two of his case for anarchist voting is fairness. Another more common argument against voting surrounds the issue of fairness. Many say that it is an unfair system. The game is rigged, points which, in truth, I cannot argue against. The system is unfair. It is biased. It is corrupt. And at time, the game isn't even rigged. But withdrawing yourself entirely from the game does nothing to change it. If the game were a sport such as football, and once you withdrew your participation, stopped, you would no longer be involved or affected, then I would encourage you to do just that. Fed up with hearing about the latest sports scores, the ludicrous rate wage demands of players, the unethical nature, you can remove yourself from the game and have nothing to do with it. It will no longer touch you. Talking about football. Unfortunately, voting and politics is a different sort of game. In fact, it isn't a game at all. Corrupt as it is, sometimes it may be unfair, undoubtedly. If you choose to withdraw from it, you will still feel its effects. Whether you participate or not, it will impact your life, for the better or for worse. And more often than not, it is the latter. If it were a game whereby you could choose not to participate, you are spared from its effects, then I would not be opposed to disengagement. But this game does not take such a form. Decisions that are made affect and inhibit us. Whether you believe it to be fair or not, you are still going to get taxed, you are still going to be subject to law, you are still going to be governed. There are many things in life that are unfair, but when faced with such a situation, we as anarchists strive to improve it, not to ignore it. Improvement cannot come without participation. And aside, the only people I feel who have disengaged effectively and entirely are those that literally like the phrase, going for the hills. This is the anarchist praxis 101. Just leave. Just go to the most remote areas possible. But of course, in the world of satellite imagery, if you are doing something the state doesn't like, they can come for you. So you just have to kind of keep to yourself and keep your head down. But to me, that might be a better way of living in some ways in your little eco village in the mountains. But as far as changing the world, not really. It's a good model. And then they support themselves by having conferences there. I'm talking about a particular eco-village. But when does it become an eco-town? How can it be an eco-city? You know, how does it scale up? You know, if it's in the mountains in these remote locations, how do you, you know, it's... Okay, so next is cost, the cost of running elections. This was mentioned in the essays very much. Cost of time, the cost of actual money that could go towards community projects on the ground. Because instead, like, basically you're investing in candidates will then utilize state money to spend on things, which can be a lot more than what you could raise yourself. So it's kind of like an investment to get some return on that investment, just as capitalists buy politicians, and they make a lot more money. But perhaps the weakest arguments put forward as to why anarchists should not vote, and the easiest to dispel, is that it... Oh yeah, so but in this case, the cost being talked about here is just the time it takes to educate yourself on who is running for office. Not so much running for office yourself. So, like, I would make the case that it's not just voting. You need to actually run for office or to actually support someone in your community to run for office. Encourage them to do that. And that has much higher cost than what this is going to talk about here. The cost of the physical act of voting itself and the cost of the taking the time to educate yourself on the parties, the policies, and the representatives that could be better spent elsewhere. Immediately, I would say that educating yourself on the political landscape of your country in which you live is never time wasted. If you do not understand the situation, you have no hope of changing it, and if you do not know anything about your enemy, you have no hope of defeating them. An intelligent and informed populace who are aware of policies and political decisions being made, and not just the clap track of the media cycle, you know, oh, is Biden creepy? The answer is yes, but as far as policy goes, it's not that, doesn't matter that much. Like, we should be attacking, I could attack Biden a number of ways. For policies, for the positions he takes, for the blasé attitude he has towards people like me. So he'll never be my candidate, and it's not just because he's handsy. Even if instead of voting and other activities you are encouraged to participate in are political in their nature, there is no reason why you cannot do both. It is never and will never be a case of voting or volunteering or voting or activism. They are two separate tactics and weapons that should be used in conjunction with one another to bring about a desired goal. They are not, never have been, mutually exclusive. But they're always talked about as if they are. And that's what I'm pushing against and this person here. And last, number four, effectiveness. It is said that Emmett Goldman once stated that if voting changed anything, they'd make it illegal. Like long-term economic plan or support our troops. It is a wonderful line to spin if you are more interested in catchphrases and slogans than actual facts. The reality is that if voting does change things, there is absolutely no denying that. Admittedly, the change may be slight, it may be slow, and it may be a change for the worse, but voting does change things. Since the last election in the UK, the bedroom tax has been introduced, which previously did not exist. Benefits, and he's talking about like the Tory government. Benefits have been cut and sanctions imposed. Universally, tuition fees trembled. NHS funding, their single-payer healthcare system, fallen. Homelessness and food banks have increased in number, and income tax for the top earners has fallen. Those are just a few of the changes that have occurred since the last time the UK voted. If voters had chosen other candidates, it is highly unlikely any of one of those changes would still have happened. Incidentally, since Goldman used that phrase, people have been voting all over the world, and today is a very different place than it was at the start of the 20th century. Quite obviously, voting hasn't been the cause of all of this change, but as I make the clear above, it plays some role. Individually, non-voters argue that their single solitary vote will never decide an election, and is therefore meaningless. On the face of it, this fact does not appear to be true. As to my knowledge, no election of history has ever been decided by a single vote. However, this thinking has both a flaw by logic and flaw by hypocrisy. How? Logically, we know that during elections, votes matter. The more votes someone has, the higher the chances of winning. So, our single solitary vote combined with a number of other single solitary votes can in fact provide victory for a chosen candidate. Elections are not individual events. They are societal events. And so our vote has to be seen in the context of voters as a whole. We are a percentage of that whole, a team, if you will. Although I do not like treating politics as team sports. A team, if you will, each individual member of that team has perfect equality in that their vote is just as important as appears. As I stated, no election, to my knowledge, has ever been won by a single vote, but there have been elections that have been won by incredibly fine margins. One of the most famous and most recent was that of Bush v. Gore. I'm fairly confident that for those who say their vote is meaningless, hypocrisy can be found throughout their day-to-day life. It is only one vote, it won't make a difference. That would be their argument. But if they truly believe that to be the case, then they would follow that principle in other aspects of their life. They would not sign any petitions because they are only one name. What difference would it make? They would not stop eating meat in order to save animal lives. After all, they're only one person. They would not shout support for their sports team. They would not participate in demonstrations or protests. They would not boycott a product or a shop. And they would not buy lottery tickets. And I'll add on, they wouldn't tweet or retweet something. Why retweet this? You're only one person. Why like that post? You're only one person. If the actions of one person are meaningless in the case of elections, then they are meaningless also in a huge number of other and pretty much all other collective tasks. So why vote? In 07, Peter Ginderloos wrote a book titled How Nonviolence Protects the State. By the same token, we can say that non-voting protects the state also. The government's most critical opponents and the ones that are feared most alongside terrorists and communists are anarchists. And yet the one legally binding opportunity where anarchists can legitimately harm the government, we choose not to do so. If I had not read the anarchist arguments against voting, then I would not have taken this whole idea as nothing more than a coercive government project to silence its most vocal critics. Persuading one's most resolute opponents not to participate in voting is a coup that any government would kill for. And some do just that. With anarchists choosing to abstain from voting, or anyone else for that matter, large numbers of population deciding against voting anyway, the task of getting reelected is made considerably easier for a government in power. They like it just the way that is. As I mentioned previously, I see voting as the easiest tool to utilize in an anarchist arsenal. It is a right that is enshrined in law and is open to a person no matter what. Marking an X in a specific box by election day can inflict a small cut to the ruling government. With enough X's and enough cuts, the government can be defeated. In the space of perhaps 48 hours, the government, who anarchists have been campaigning against for nearly 5 years, can be removed from office. The argument here would be that though one government would be removed, another would soon take its place. This is true, but in this instance, it would be a government that the anarchists have played some role in electing. It would represent the lesser evils available, and though this government would not be the utopian vision many would want, it would not represent the revolution we desire to see, it would still be a step in the right direction. And then it goes on about effects of voting, and I'll just end there and move on to the next topic. Welcome back to the Three Left Show, Inspector Haunting Community Radio. All spooks here. Because I'm not even talking about the candidates and the Dem candidates. I don't care. I'm not a Democrat, okay? I'm not a Democrat. Let me say that again. I'm not a Democrat. You can ask for my opinions on individual candidates and, you know, whether it's family members or people in my social networks. You know, the media cycle, week in, week out, is a different candidate or what a different candidate's doing or talking about. Now there's like 20 of them. I don't know what the full count is right now, but it's so many. And they are all problems to me. I don't really care. Yes, even Bernie. I mean, I don't hate Bernie. I love Bernie. You know, whatever. Bernie's fine. But if you were president, like there are, like as I said, as I related, Syriza, far left wing government. Imagine a whole party of Bernie Sanders, not just one person running in a presidential primary, but a whole party of Bernie Sanders take government, and then they can't implement their agenda at all. And if Bernie Sanders is the next president, he would still be the manager of capitalism. It might be a nicer capitalism with more co-ops, or it might be a nicer capitalism with more unions, but again, it's like if there's more unions and higher minimum wages, just like the last few years, we've been getting these gains have been made because of mass movements, not because of elections. I see elections as an organizing tool or as an outreach tool, specifically outreach, about creating a vision. I need to rewrite this stuff, but it just comes down to you have all these different movements. Let me get closer to the mic. You have all these different movements for all these different causes. A party just brings them into one organization, which otherwise doesn't exist. You have such organizations that attempt to, but then they end up basically being co-opted by the Democratic Party. They end up becoming an arm of capitalism, and I never want to work with them or work in them. I just see another faceless corporation at the end of the day. A party is not a nonprofit. It is independent. It can do whatever it wants. And that's how I see the Greens. But the Greens have a lot of roadblocks in front of them. You know, we are a national party, but there's a lot of voting reforms. I mean, I think everyone's now aware, maybe not. Everyone still needs to be fully educated on this. But we have a very corrupt system. Money in politics is, you know, the swamp. Even right-wingers that love Trump, they agree. There's a swamp. There's corruption. Money in politics is a problem. You have corporate power, and it's the big guy versus the little guy. They just see, like, Trump as a little guy who got to the top of the pyramid. Of course, he isn't that, but they can have their delusions. But they're not deluded about certain problems, like money in politics. But how do you get money out of politics? It seems like a paradox, like many kind of policy things, a catch-22 of we need to get money out of politics, but we can't because there's money in politics. So here is from Cosmonaut, a left-wing blog of sorts. And Jonah Martell lays out a vision for a socialist electoral strategy called the article is called Conquest of Ballots. He published this September of last year. Okay, so in January of 2018, the Democratic Socialist, DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, adopted an ambitious new electoral strategy, denounced both the Republican and Democratic parties as organs of the capitalist ruling class, true, and declared that its goal was to build an independent socialist political power. Good. The resolution was a clear break from the strategy of the DSA's founder, Michael Harrington, who hoped to gradually realign the Democratic Party to the left. But that's been their goal for the last 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. How's that going for them? However, the resolution did not call for DSA to reconstitute itself as an independent political party. It remained open to running candidates in Democratic primaries, and even to local chapters endorsing non-socialist politicians on a case-by-case basis. This flexible approach is helping DSA members win unprecedented electoral victories, most notably AOC, but it also has its fair share of detractors who argue that any engagement with the Democratic Party is misguided and opportunistic. Whether this assessment is accurate or not, DSA's decision to avoid an all-out break with the Democrats has a net rational basis. As the organization stated before its leftward shift, the process and structure of American elections have doomed third-party efforts. Depends on what you think a success is, though. The United States is perhaps the most repressive electoral system in the developed world. Most states enforce draconian ballot access requirements and strictly regulate the organizational structure of political parties. Meanwhile, and this is very important to me, that like there were rules in our bylaws that like I don't think we should have, but I'm told no state law requires us to have this in our bylaws. I'm like, ugh, I'm a mother. Meanwhile, gerrymandering by both major parties has seated undemocratic legislators, entrenched incumbent politicians, and made many elections uncompetitive. Perhaps most importantly, nearly all American elections are based on plurality voting in a single-member district. This system creates a media-hyped spoiler effect in which marginal candidates draw votes away from one of the two major parties, unintentionally help the other. And he uses the 2000 example, but I'm going to point out that's bullcrap. More recently, though, it helped, and this is a better example, but it's not a Green or a third party doing this. More recently, it helped a vicious reactionary Paul LePage win two gubernatorial elections in May, one with less than 38% of the vote. But yeah, he was able to govern, wasn't he? Over time, the spoiler effect has threatened. By the way, so that's because you'd have a Democrat, and then you'd have a more progressive Democrat run as an independent. Okay? And I want to draw a very distinct difference between a third party and a non-party slash independent candidate. All right? Now, an independent, basically not having any label whatsoever, sometimes it's a given, it seems, that they have a better chance of being elected because then they have no other baggage. And that they can basically be anything to anybody. They can basically be just a less corrupt Democrat, which is usually the case. And as far as politics go, Bernie Sanders is a non-corrupt or less corrupt Democrat. Which is why, like, it's funny when they say he's not a Democrat. He's an independent. Well, he's not any other party. He's not in opposition to the Democrat. So, let's continue. Only extensive reforms can remove these obstacles. Okay, so, you know, we do want an independent third party, this writer writes. But the impediments stop that from occurring. Meanwhile, the Greens are trying to actually do all that stuff. To most observers, it seems like a hopeless situation, and even some socialists have called on the American left to accept that we must work within the two-party system. We should reject this defeatist outlook. Totally agree. The socialist project has always strived to win the battle of democracy to achieve universal suffrage and other reforms that challenge capitalists. If our goal is to build a principled socialist movement with a revolutionary ambition, the very idea of a two-party rule should be noxious to us. We must fight it tooth and nail. We need to conquer the ballot to force a democratizing overhaul. So he uses the example of in Michigan. How do you do this? So you can't do it within elections because then you have to go through all of those filters, all of these barriers. And even if you get elected, then you have to basically play ball, so to speak. You know, give a little, get a little. So there's a Voters Not Politicians campaign in December of 2017 in Michigan. It announced that it had collected enough petition signatures to put a novel initiative on the ballot for 2018. If it passed, it would alter the state's redistricting process by stripping the Republican-dominated legislature of its power to draw the districts. Instead, redistricting would be conducted by an independent panel of volunteers, selected by lot in a manner similar to juries. In a state like Michigan, where gerrymandering is rampant, this would represent a groundbreaking reform. Success of the signature drive is particularly impressive because it was an all-volunteer campaign run on a shoestring budget, without a single pay petition circulator. Over 425,000 people signed this initiative, showing its popularity, and polls indicate that a clear majority of Michigan voters support it. If they are given the chance, they will almost certainly pass it, which is why its opponents, backed by state's Chamber of Commerce, fought bitterly to block it in the courts. In July of this year, they lost, with Michigan Supreme Court ruling that the measure would remain on the ballot. Despite right-wing attempts at obstruction, the lessons of this campaign are clear. Even with limited resources, the voters, not politicians, grassroots organizers can use ballot initiatives to bypass the establishment. 24 states in Washington, D.C., and countless local governments allow for some form of citizen-led ballot initiative. If one group in Michigan could mount such an intriguing campaign, what could a national organization like the DSA accomplish if it adopted such a strategy? If we want to use ballot initiatives as a springboard for mass mobilization, we should emphasize broadly democratic reforms like this Michigan anti-gerrymandering measure. American voters on both the left and right are acutely aware of gerrymandering and universally hate it. So it's a low-hanging fruit, a soft target, if it were. If they also hate the influence of corporate money in politics, we should also demand extensive public financing. Although right-wingers are pretty much against it because it's like it's social spending and they hate that. We could establish ourselves as a unique force willing to challenge both Republicans and Democratic hacks, winning over a mass constituency, so on. The same principle applies to reforms that more directly challenge the two-party system. 60% of Americans and 71% of millennials feel that the U.S. needs a competitive third party. So there's always this demand for a third party. There's never a follow-up question of what kind of party. Is it farther left of you? Is it further right? People are thinking like, oh, it's the party that completely aligns with me. I'd like to have more in-depth discussions about that with people. But I don't really encounter these people in real life, actually. I think those that express that they want a third party are usually involved in either some fusion party or something. But here, this article is just about initiatives. And in outlining some of those reforms that could be passed with initiatives, like instant runoff voting, which allows voters to rank multiple candidates in order of preference, instead of choosing only one. If one candidate receives a clear majority, a series of simulated runoffs are conducted until one candidate emerges. Instant runoff does not produce proportional representation, though, but it does help third-party candidates compete by largely eliminating the spoiler effect. I'm not really, like, down with this line because the spoiler effect isn't real. It's like a made-up threat. I mean, we could threaten Democrats with the spoiler effect, you know, because so, I mean, enough people believe in it. I guess that makes it real, but it isn't real. I think I made the case in last fall that the 3% that say a third party just by being on the ballot, not really a strong campaign, but like they get 3%. The 3% isn't from the Democratic base. Those are people that would have sat at home. They wouldn't have participated because there was no candidate to vote for them. Just like how I'm waiting, you know, I'm a non-voter and I'm waiting for a third party to vote for. Okay, well, how it's not going to manifest like magic, okay? It's not going to come out of nowhere. I think they expect, like, well, these businesses that I like came out of nowhere. Like, but they didn't. Some millionaire paid for it. Or some billionaire, some capitalist funded that. All right? Whatever it is that you like. Grubhub. Service you use. All right? They expect politics to work the same way. But no, if that works the same way, that's exactly the problem. They want people look for candidates, and those candidates are provided by capital. Capital pays for that. The exceptions are guys like Bernie, who are in fact funded by small donations. And that's through years of hype and organizing and grunt work. But Bernie Sanders didn't come out of nowhere. He has been a politician for decades, climbing the bladder, scaling the pyramid to be a senator, right? And he had to make compromises every step of the way. He had to, you know, kind of turn away from the more radical politics now and then. Working state by state, back to the article, we could implement instant runoff voting for both House and Senate elections. Just a few successful initiatives could have tremendous political implications. Florida and California both allow ballot initiatives, and together they account for almost 20% of the seats in the House of Reps. In summary, our electoral reform program should raise five key demands. Citizen-controlled redistricting to counter gerrymandering. Public financing of elections. Elimination of restrictive ballot access laws. Deregulation of political parties. And an end to plurality rule in single-member districts, which could entail proportional representation in state legislators. An instant runoff voting at the federal level. Taken individually, these reforms could be policy tweaks that any liberal technocrat could propose. But if we push them collectively as part of a broader radical movement, they could revolutionize working class politics and smash the two-party system. Maybe. Maybe. But there are some perils. These are just questions of strategy. Just questions like, only close to half of the states allow for initiatives. Here in New York, we don't have initiative process. So we're kind of stuck with this. We can't use this strategy. Not a pitfall, but like using the spoiler stick to be implement these reforms, Democrats, or we will challenge you and force you to lose. Again, it's like it's such a tortured logic that like, look, if you're going to lose by 3% of the vote, you weren't a strong candidate in the first place. And that goes for Clinton. I mean, she got more votes in 2016, but she lost because she didn't campaign properly. She created Trump. And I got to remind people of that. Like, in the leaked emails, okay, the important emails, there were emails about their media strategy of telling all of their media operatives, because the Clinton machine has a lot of sway in all of the cable news networks, to cover Trump more. And as Trump was covering more, you had more Republicans or conservatives saying, you know, I think there's something about this, Trump. Their first reaction might have been negative. Oh, what a clown. He doesn't know what he means. But the more they were watching him, just like with any advertisement, it just gets stuck in your head and it's all you can think about. And they couldn't think about anyone else because of how much Trump was covered. To the point where even the liberal network, MSNBC, was covering Trump more than Bernie. Perils on the path. There are no easy answers to questions like, should we push our reforms incrementally or all at the same time? Which state should we target first? How can we raise the funds necessary to mount credible campaigns? Should we always rely on volunteers, as the voters, not politicians, did in Michigan? Or will paid signature collectors sometimes be necessary? There are no easy answers to these questions, but if the DSA and other socialist orgs chooses to adopt this strategy, it will have to grapple with them regardless. We will need a flexible approach that can be adapted to each state's political context and regulatory limits. Only two things seem to be clear. First, that we should generally gain experience organizing these initiatives at a local level before we attempt them at a state level. And second, we cannot win electoral reform all by ourselves. We will need to find allies willing to support additional support to our project. This may entail partnerships. And by the way, so this is from the perspective of the DSA, but I think it goes for any kind of organization you are. This is like general advice and strategy. And I think everyone should care about it. This may entail partnerships with a wide variety of existing third parties, wink, wink, as well as elements of organized labor. Coalitions of this type will not form overnight. It will take years of work to bring them together. We must maintain our independence every other way, working closely with other organizations. The initiative strategy also has a geographic limit because only 24 states have an initiative process, and the other 26, our road to victory will be more complicated. In areas where our movement is strong and Democrats are politically dominant, we could also use a spoiler effect to our advantage. Far ahead of a given election, we could publicly announce a plan to run our candidates on independent socialist line, and yeah, spoiler stick. But I want to get to the point about Maine. But the initiative effort in Maine also illustrates the greatest. So a ranked choice ballot initiative was put forward in Maine, and so yeah, here's some details on that. illustrates the greatest obstacle to electoral reform, capitalist sabotage. Despite a clear majority support for the initiative, Maine Republicans have staunchly opposed instant runoff voting, which led to the state Supreme Court to issue a non-binding opinion in 2017 claiming that most of the initiative's provisions are unconstitutional. This opinion gave members of the state legislature, including some wary Democrats, an excuse to pass a bill that effectively repealed the initiative. Only after another second initiative, signed by over 80,000 people, was able to block this bill by subjecting it to a veto referendum at the state's recent primary elections. On June 12th, Maine voters decided once again to save instant runoff, but the court opinion has ensured that it will only be used in the state's federal elections. So it's pretty much a quarter loaf. Reform efforts in other parts of the country have been met with similar obstruction. In 2008, 65% of Santa Fe, New Mexico voters passed initiative for instant runoff voting in their elections. The city government responded by simply ignoring them, with the Democratic mayor even claiming that they, quote, voted for the concept without understanding what it meant. What a dick. Local officials dragged their feet on the initiative for years, refusing to implement it until an activist group sued them, and then the New Mexico Supreme Court ordered them to back down. In March this year, Santa Fe voters used the new system for the first time after waiting for a decade. From Maine to Michigan, Michigan to Maine. Socialists can anticipate all of these pitfalls to take steps to address them. We can write our reforms carefully to minimize legal obstruction, promote them effectively so that voters overwhelmingly support them, and sue whenever officials refuse to implement them. But even if we make all the right decisions, there is no way around it. Electoral reform will face formidable opposition from our elites. Occasionally, we may wring concessions from both parties of capital, but in general, they unite in bitter hostility to any movement that wants to increase democracy, especially if it is championed by the radical left. The conquest of ballots will not be bipartisan. Every step of the way, it will bring conflict, and we will want to win. We can't shy away from it. Instead, we must embrace the battle, using it to radicalize working people and professional people sometimes, and forge an independent party of the left. It's time for us to take this narrow road for electoral reform. Okay. And I'm just going to cut it to some music. First, an outro. My profound thanks for listening to the show. Listening is an important skill, often as important as talking, so I plan to listen to any constructive feedback you send me, ideas for the show, or stories and topics you'd like to hear me discuss. Capitalism doesn't believe work like this of mine is worth paying a wage for, but you can support the show materially via Patreon page, Three Left Show, and I'm also on Twitter and Facebook. You can also find any archive of episodes at threelefts.news. That's where all the shows are archived. This is also podcasted. I edit all this down, or at least take all the garbage out, and post that on all of the major podcast apps. So I just want to tell you how beautiful you all are. Thank you for listening and putting up with me. So thank you very much, and be well.